Been here earlier on when I welcomed everybody earlier on. I would very much like to extend a second thank you to Jelle B for the outstanding performance just before. Thank you. And I would like to note that their work in progress in collaboration with video artist Adi Schniedermann and myself for Joyce Soho is in the making and premieres at the end of May. So everybody that can make it. And I also would like to, again, very much like to extend my thanks to you at NIR who performed for this very occasion on the cello. Now I would like to hand over the microphone to our panel on architecture and art with some outstanding people from the field. And I would like to hand over the microphone to Michael Wang, who's going to moderate the discussion. As you can see, the way it's set up, it's a round table. And don't feel shy to squeeze into the panelists. There's also a projection there, and there is a keyboard just below it. If you have any questions, comments, or anything else in terms of what the panel might react to, feel free to just type it in there. Thank you very much, and I'm handing it over to Michael now.
Hello. Thanks, Matthias, Alois, and James for inviting us. And we'll do our best to keep an eye on the screen, but we'll also leave time after an hour to formally address questions also if we don't get to any of those. So first I'll just introduce the panelists. I'll start from my left. We have William O'Brien Jr., who's an assistant professor of architecture at MIT School of Architecture and Planning and is a principal of an independent design practice in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We have Alicia Wormsley, is a Brooklyn-based multimedia artist, photographer, teaching artist, and writer. We have David Rui, who's an architect, theorist, co-director of Roy Klein, an experimental design office in New York City. Alan Wexler is the principal of Alan Wexler Studio. He teaches at Parsons and is represented by Ronald Feldman Gallery in New York. And Diana Belmori, the founding principal of Belmori Associates Landscape and Urban Design Firm in New York City. So given the diverse interests and practices of our panelists and the varied practices of the artists, architects, and dancers included in the show, I'd like to begin with the discussion on the subject of interdisciplinarity. So as the disciplines of art and architecture both expand, it becomes ever more difficult to determine what will set apart an explicitly interdisciplinary endeavor from the everyday concerns of practicing artists and architects. We have artists who work like architects. You can think of someone like Olafur Eliasson, who runs his studio on the model of an architectural practice. We have architects who started their practices in the art world, Bernard Schumi. Artists who have become architects, Vito Acconci. Architects who work primarily for art world clients, someone like David Adjaye. Artists whose work engages or fetishizes architectural forms or contents, Josiah McElhaney, or even photographers like Candida Hofer or Andreas Gursky. Architects who divide their practice between architectural work and more artistic work, Liz Diller. Artists whose practice comes out of architectural training, say, Tony Smith. Architects who are great artists, the Gehry model. And artists who engage research strategies that overlap with those of architectural design development, someone like Natalie Jeremijenko. Given this apparently productive crossing of disciplines or a crisis of disciplinarity, I'd like to ask each of the panelists to discuss their thoughts and the status of interdisciplinarity today, its usefulness as a term, or their own experiences in crossing disciplinary boundaries, especially since many of the panelists wear different hats or work in fields that are by their very definition between disciplines, such as landscape architecture, urban design, or theoretical practices. So you all can just grab these microphones. We're going to leave them on the table. We have two.
Well,
I guess I was just talking to Lisa about how her work operates between public art and architecture, and maybe she can talk about some of her experiences with that.
Okay. Hi, everybody. So we're talking about art and architecture and interdisciplinary work. In my experience, I'm a public artist. Started out as a public artist, painting murals, creating sculptures in public places. The beginning part of my experience was all pretty much using architecture as a canvas. So usually when you create a public art piece, you walk into a neighborhood or see a wall or whatever, and you have to use that architecture as your canvas. Recently, however, I've been fortunate enough to be chosen to work with a group of architects in Rotterdam where they are actually doing the opposite of that, where public art is being incorporated into the structure of the cities and the structure of how they're creating the cities. So it's really interesting to see how, even in this experience, experiencing the artwork here, where let's say Alois's work, kind of is created, maybe, it's formed with the walls that are in this space, and then also I was fortunate enough to see him transform it into something that would work with the architecture of in Miami or wherever he would put that work. So I think that as far as interdisciplinary, just thinking about how architecture and public art work, where this is fine art, it's very interesting for me to see fine art kind of sculpted by architecture and architecture sculpted by fine art, which is the same in what I do publicly. I don't know exactly what we are kind of going with on that, but that's just my thoughts on interdisciplinary. I can pass it on.
Okay. My turn. Couple of observations on the subject matter that you're bringing to our attention. There are a lot of different terms for this. There's multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary, maybe even just people getting together to do something. Maybe that's another way to talk about it. I think it may seem very technical, the differences between these terms, and somewhat academic, why you would use one word versus the other. And they go against the grain of a kind of intuitive observation we can make. If you have an artist and an architect who seem to have similar interests, what's so wrong about them getting together to collaborate and do something? So just on the face of it, the complexity of different disciplines getting together seems to be somewhat artificial. However, given the context within which certain works get done, then I think these different terms become pretty important. For example, at the university, the interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary directive, which is pretty common to every university now today, this comes down from the top. Presidents of university just say, we want multidisciplinary work. And why do they do this? It's a combination of two problems. One, the disparity between scientific disciplines and the humanities and the revenue streams for each. There is a desire to somehow manage the overall university in more synergistic ways. So there's a kind of management aspect to it. Second, there is the interest of inventing new disciplines. So for example, bioengineering is something that didn't exist 50 years ago. So you had biologists and you had engineers, and there was no department of bioengineering, now there is. And that is an amazing thing for a new form of knowledge to be invented. Similarly, depending on where the money is coming from, what the project is for, each of these terms and why collaboration makes sense or do not make sense, I think is a pretty important part of the story. Perhaps for art and architecture, it's a much easier form of collaboration, but even there, I think comparing the economy of having a client commissioning the architect to do a building versus a gallery sponsoring work and selling the work, they're very different kinds of things. So perhaps there could be some thought about perhaps new vehicles that would then allow a new kind of work to come about. Yeah.
In 1972, I graduated from School of Architecture, and I was interested in, I liked building things, and I didn't like the delay that occurred in within an architectural practice. I really like it when architects call me an artist, and artists call me an architect. I'm kind of in between, and I've been there since 72. It really depends on the context that I'm working within or exploring. And it's a kind of area that allows me, in a way, to be an architect without clients. It's chosen to be that way, so that I can explore a series of projects, construct them myself, and then move on to other issues and focuses within that practice. I remember when I was a student and I was fairly naive and I didn't have a very good background in art or architecture, coming from a very bad high school, and I first discovered Andy Warhol, and I found his work so exciting and innovative and interesting, and I realized that Andy Warhol's initials, AW, were the same as mine, Alan Wexler, and I thought I wanted to be the Andy Warhol of architecture, and I've been trying to explore that area. There's some luxury in working outside of the field in that you could, in a way, it's a protective device. I can always use the excuse that within the category of architecture, if I do project, I can act naive and childlike because I'm not, quote, an architect, but within the category of art, I can do the same. So it's a kind of protective device, and I really like that area of exploration.
I wanted to say that when I came out of the exhibit about 3 days ago looking at all of the pieces here, I was trying to sort of put it all in one small word or in one, because I'm a visual person, in some sort of an image. And I was thinking that this image, I don't know if you can see it, it's a very straight line and a very thick line. It sort of described what I was seeing, in the sense that I think that art and architecture had this sort of dividing line, this very straight, very severe line in between them up to very recently. And that what has happened in the last 15 years or is that the edges have become much less defined, and that there's a wide band or a thick line in which all kinds of things appear. And therefore, say if I take Lanchester's Dimaxion or Bucky Fuller Dome over here, comes to the sort of straighter line of the edge, and somebody like Dilworth or the video over there, or this wonderful set of screens, are somewhere much more less defined. And I think that if we're going to work, all of us, in whatever our fields are, that this very thick area is the part where we can all suddenly, I think that's the creative place to be in the in-between. I think that that's where all the seeds are sort of germinating, to put a landscape simile there. But I also think that particularly in my field of landscape versus architecture, this was, in the modern movement, a very severe line which you couldn't cross without sort of breaking into a lawsuit. We are in a very different place now.
Diana's drawing makes me think about the distinctions between ways of thinking about organization as an architect or as an artist. I'm thinking particularly of the line, the straight line, being representative of, say, as Michael was alluding to, the modernist movement being about representation, being about precision, being about artificial environments, juxtaposed with a way of thinking about organization which is much more inclusive and much more open to being affected by other layers, other disciplines, thinking particularly of things like nowadays ecology, meteorology, landscape, bioengineering, art. And I think the distinction between maybe disciplinarity in modernist period and interdisciplinarity now is that we get to or have to deal with the extra layers, the extra information that has something to say to the way that architects organize. And I think it's a really exciting time precisely because of that, because traditional modes of organization that were based in representation, you know, with the May line and the pencil, are now being challenged by other ways of seeing environmental conditions or other understandings of atmospheres, or you fill in the blank. There are a number of ways that we now can think about organization of building materials that are informed by a whole range of new ways of understanding information. And so I think we're at a very interesting slash tricky point where we have to make some tough decisions about what layers of information we have to allow to be layered into some of our design work, and which layers we have to decide to rule out. Do we have a question up on the board here?
I'm a proponent of the straight line because it looks, because human bodies and human movement and activity look so beautiful in contrast to the straight line. And I think if we look very closely at the straight line, it's not so straight. If you look at that straight line under magnifying glass, it's very irregular.
I like the thickened line also. I think someone once said that architecture is never a single line, it's always a double line, that there has to be a space of inhabitation. Yeah. And I think that that thickness gives that sort of space of inhabitation, the sort of territorial inhabitation that you're also talking about that could be between disciplines, which I actually think leads a little bit to my next question, which is that one of the propositions of this show is the idea that art and architecture are not discrete practices but share certain territory. And that for this exhibition, that space is one of the most compelling sites of intersection, which is a very modern concern, beginning with Siegfried Gideon's, what he called the new space conception in the Renaissance, with the development of a single point perspective, and leading towards the idea of a continuous free-flowing space, advocated by Bruno Tsevi in the work of Frank Lloyd Wright. Here, architecture no longer sits in space, but is composed of space. Today, we have all kinds of terms, like Rem Koolhaas's junk space, that almost, you know, they're sort of the denigration of the spatial, and these are the terms that dominate architectural discussions. But I'd like to ask the panelists what, for them, are some of the most pressing concerns surrounding this idea of space and how it's changed today.
One of the things people are really afraid of in interdisciplinary work, something I'm very afraid of when I collaborate, is for my discipline to be diluted in some way. And to some degree, that's inevitable. Just to communicate, you can't use all the words that we normally use. For example, a lot of the language I use when I teach in the Department of Architecture, I won't use tonight because you'll think I'm completely nuts, right? And nor would I be understood. But that's not necessarily a bad thing either, because that is sometimes the strength of the discipline, that it has a history, and because it has a history, there's been intense conversation and thinking along a certain trajectory. So when the disciplines merge, a lot of that ends up having to be sacrificed. So in order to move on with such collaborations, it becomes really important what I think to be very clear about what the purpose is, just so each party knows why you're giving up what you're giving up in order to merge or inhabit that complex zone in between. And in the best possible case, I think what we're hoping for is we discover something that in the world that we find inadequacy, that there's a territory we're looking for that simply doesn't exist. And at that point, I think you need gambles, like, for example, the gallery owner saying we're going to have a show that where pieces are not necessarily going to be sold. In fact, we have no idea like who the collectors would even be. And take a gamble, because you never know if there would actually be a context for it after it's done. So, and you hope that such initiatives then change the context and there are new opportunities. So,
I just think it's really interesting that, well, first of all, you're all architects, and I'm an artist. So thinking about how art is created based on the space that it's in, thinking about art created within walls, within, if it's outside, within nature, within, you know, whatever space, even, you know, taking the piece that's outside the ATM machine, you know, someone created that ATM machine to fit in small spaces within the architecture of a bodega or, you know, any, wherever it's going to be on the street. But when you're, you know, this show's kind of the opposite in that way, as far as using the space that, you know, the artist created this work and set it in this space, but thinking about architecture in the reverse kind of way. That's how I look at this show, that it's kind of like the art was created and then the architecture kind of goes around it. I don't know.
I think there's a brilliant choreographic idea here, which is to bring dance into this space. Because I always thought of architecture as choreography without the choreographer. And if you imagined, for instance, tracing the movement of your body from early this morning until now, what an amazing space that form would create. This truly a space of that thickened line that, you know, if you just created the envelope that you moved within in this space that is both conditioned by the architecture that controls your movement, but you're controlling the architecture as well.
Michael had brought up the issue of space, and I think that one of the things that we need to modify it by right now is time, and that in all of our attempts to understand space, and somehow you were talking about choreography, which is displacement through space, and that element of the spatial displacement that takes place over time is one of the dimensions of space that now interests us more than anything else, and that in a way also at the same time it has something to do with the fact that we are considering space in time of a sort of something that has to do with life, that it is a system which changes every instant, and that therefore the spatial movement is a form of expression of the constant change. Now, where I want to go there is, where I want to go from there is this fact that all of these attempts that are in these rooms have in some way tried to incorporate some element of time in them, and I find them incredibly interesting from the point of view of the, you know, either the shopping mall or the facade of the building seen through the window, or the chalk lines that can be altered in this thing. And therefore, I think that therefore our conception of space now is much more tied to time. And I know that Gideon said space, time, and architecture, but the time issue is perhaps prevailing as the way, the only way to get to space.
Yeah. If I could just piggyback on that, it seems like in previous projects, time might have been registered by art or architecture. And increasingly, it seems as though art and architecture are trying to find a way of making a similar vocabulary or creating a similar vocabulary so that temporality in both the spaces that we make and through, say, natural processes, that there are ways of starting to interlink those. I'm thinking particularly of landscape projects where there's the challenge of taking, say, cycles of cultural cycles, the way we inhabit types of spaces, the way that we use certain kinds of programs, and how that might be thought in terms of natural processes. And the seeming disparity of those scales, natural processes may be happening over seasons, years, etc., and cultural functions, the patterns that come equipped with cultural functions might happen over days and weeks and months and years, and trying to find ways to integrate cultural patterns and natural processes is absolutely requires a mutual understanding of temporality, dynamicism with the spatial. So that could be another way that we're getting toward this idea of interdisciplinarity.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like all of these issues that are coming up, sort of time over space, some of the questions that are being posted up here, there's the question of what is the legacy of architecture without architects. You know, there's a question sort of asking what exactly defines architecture. Is it just the definition of space with structure? And I think that all of these sorts of trajectories of questioning are sort of embedded in both this discussion and the show itself. I mean, some of these pieces are kind of provocations about that very definition of architecture. I'm thinking right now of the video by Interboro about the sort of reappropriation of the shopping mall, that's the kind of architecture without architects, right? That each of these sort of remain areas for questioning. And I think this issue of this sort of the speed of architecture is again a kind of a new way of questioning the sort of primariness of space and determining architectural form, that maybe it's not so much about space now as it was in a kind of period of high modernism, that instead it's about sort of the fastness of surfaces or the a temporal experience of the building or of not even buildings but a kind of urban experience. So I think it's sort of we're in the same mode of questioning as what's being posted up here, as are the sort of works in the show. But maybe I'll just move on again, sort of jumping off from questions about space. To a very different trajectory, which is we're already starting to approach, but which is the role of place in determining an artwork or a building. Since this show evidences particular interest in site specificity, not in space necessarily, but in place. And we see these very slight displacements with the video projections, the Matthias' dance collaboration in the hallway, the potentially subversive sighting of the ATM machine at the entrance to the gallery, this redistribution of views, and also the projection of a possible sustainable future in Bess Kriegmeier's digitally rendered video, or the exchange and displacement of building stairwells with Dimitra and Irene Sakralia's drawing performances. Place becomes here a kind of artistic or architectural variable. At the limit of the site-specific work, we see architecture and the art object, they become nothing more than a site. This is a condition approached in some land art. And so, to the panelists, how for your own practice, or what are some of your observations from this show or from elsewhere, where place, as something very different potentially from space, becomes a kind of artistic or architectural concern?
Yeah, I think that question of how you define site or how you define the spot within which your piece will go is actually a really interesting conundrum. The stuff that I work on is mostly architectural, but attempts to put a toe into landscape. And so when I teach that same way. And it's so interesting to see students who have been taught that a site for architecture ends where the lot line ends, right? That's where it ends. That's the entire site. Nothing goes beyond that. And then to suggest that there are other processes that go on outside of that sight line, just see their mind reeling. That's the way that I was taught. I was initially taught that the lot is the lot, and you operate within that. I see increasingly different conceptions of sight, those which are much more inclusive and those which address far more reaching systemic layers of systemic information as a way to challenge conventional notions of sight. And that's just one way of thinking about it, the way that landscape and architecture are starting to blur more and more. But I think it's happening in several other ways also. But I'd be curious to hear the other panelists. How do you think of sight these days in relative to previous times of thinking about sight?
I remember in the 80s, there was I guess it was called contextualism, and architects were very concerned about making sure that the cornice lines lined up and the window lines, and there were relationships between the building and its surroundings, and that's kind of what you're talking about. Like one of my favorite buildings is Mises' Brick Country House, because that really deals only with the site, you know, and it goes right out to the edges of the site. Interior becomes exterior, exterior becomes interior. But in terms of this exhibition, I really appreciate the dance performances that took place in the hallways, in which there was a kind of x-ray through the wall. In other words, the dance and the film and the video it became a window. And then also that relationship between art, high style art, versus what might be called everyday art, which is the work in that the kind of the quote mundane work of the office, is now seen as beautiful dance performance. And I think that juxtaposition of really beautiful choreography in the office, while we see people, you know, working behind their desks, and then we start to, become confused. What is art, and what's beautiful, and what's not beautiful? It's like, you know, as Cage said, "Is there ever a time when beauty will become ugly, and ugly will become beautiful?" And I think that performance starts to play with those issues, where the dancers become office workers, and the office workers become dancers, and that is the blurring of boundaries that happens in terms of context, not just in terms of disciplines.
I was noticing, as often happens in performance art, as the dancers were moving through the space, very naturally, this kind of invisible border formed. So people in the audience became very wary of that border, as though there was a piece of glass there or something. And the dancers were also very good, I think, at aggressively testing where that boundary was. And I think it demonstrates, I think, a very interesting problem for each discipline, and something that does remain very distinct about art versus architecture. What each discipline has trouble doing, I think, is interesting to observe. Art has always had some degree of anxiety and trouble in its ability to become site-specific, that its tendency is to not be, because it tends to make a world of its own. And this is your very old frame discussion, or framing discussion. Whereas in architecture, it has an incredibly difficult time not being site-specific. And that's always been, to a large degree, my own frustration as an architect, to escape the exigencies and the practicalities of that moment where you're asked to make a building or a piece of architecture. And it's incredibly difficult to escape that, to propose a world in and of itself. So for that reason, I myself have been compelled to put on a different hat at moments to escape the confines of architecture. And I wasn't going to mention this today, but I'm actually also represented by a gallery. And when the gallery sells my work, they don't advertise the fact that I'm an architect, or else their collectors would not purchase them, and which is very interesting. And similarly, I never talk about the fact that I do work in a gallery when I'm talking to clients, and there is a definitely a division there, and I think it has something to do with the question of the world and to what degree each one is in it, or which world it's in, and works like this are quite good, I think, at poking at that invisible boundary to make a grotesque Buckminster Fuller Ball. I find incredibly refreshing and to some degree inspiring. And I could say something about all the projects, but maybe I'll leave it.
Okay, you want to go ahead? Are you okay? Well, I just also think that it's really interesting to think about the fact that artists are always testing boundaries. They're always trying to leap outside of whatever is containing them. And that architecture, in my mind, seems to be the art of containing. So I don't know if that's correct or not. Maybe you guys want to tell me if that is or not. But that, it's just really interesting to see that those kind of that reversal, what Alex was talking about, and that reversal.
Look there.
Yeah.
That's, they're not containing, and yet they're defining, but letting the space run through. Right. So in a way, they're breaking that line of just containment. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a great example of sort of going against that only containment. Right. And I think that even in the most contained time of architecture in the modern movement, even the Johnson's Glass House or the of Mises Farnsworth House was somehow trying to break it and play that you could go through it. You felt that because they were all glass, that the landscape traversed them, although they were in fact very sealed boxes. But they were trying. I mean, it was a beginning of trying to see if the object could dissolve. And we're beginning to, I think, dissolve the object. But I was going to take a stance about the site-specific. Because landscape, of course, is very site-specific. And in a way, I've taken some of my students up in a plane, in a little plane, in order to see how that site, in fact, tied to this whole system of water and, and all, and the forest over there and so on and so forth. And then you begin to see, that this site is sort of a part of a much bigger system. And also to look at this official geology, in which you begin to see that what's under the surface of what you see may be quite absolutely surprising and very important to what you're doing. And yet, I would take a stance against site specificity in the sense that I really think that, and I know that we've discussed site specificity for, the last decade as far as seeing how important it was. I really think that scale is enormously more important than site specificity. And that what happens is that when you are working at the right scale, then you happen to hit the site specificity well. And if you don't work at the right scale, you don't. But you don't do it in order to be site specific. You do it because you're playing until you can find the right scale. I was going to make a general statement that you're all going to attack, but anyway, I was just going to say that if the modern movement, for example, was incredibly good at working at the scale of a single building, but it was terrible at working at the scale of a city, and I would say that the landscape today It lost its way in the 60s, in which it thought it could deal with enormous cities and all of that, and it can't. And today it's sort of found a middle scale and it's got the right tools. So it's not that design can do everything at every time, in every place, in every discipline. I think that the disciplines that succeed are the ones that find the scale in their particular time. And I think that, you know, that has much more to do with site specificity, but it's going through the back door. It's entering through the back door in some way.
Well, I actually think a lot of the examples that the panelists are bringing up actually express this tension between the autonomous object, the site-specific work. I mean, the example of the brick country house, I mean, to read that in terms of site specificity is at odds with the sort of purity of that diagram, right, that looks like it's a pure kind of a diagram for a spatial relationship. And so I think a lot of these examples are sort of somehow in between the two. And when you brought up the performance today, that again was another idea of how the artwork here, the performance artwork, might provisionally actually describe a kind of placement of a line or a boundary, which is something that's sort of very changeable, and yet it's also something that has nothing to do with a kind of classical conception of place as something that's, you know, grounded in the spirit of place, a kind of genius loci. That this is something that's portable and is actually contained within the artwork itself.
I keep thinking about what the basic, and I see it as a question up on the screen there, what is the basic difference between art and architecture? And I think it's a lot, and it's also very little. And I keep thinking that perhaps the basic difference is an issue of one is self-directed research, and the other is externally directed research. In other words, architects have what some people might call restrictions and boundaries. I call media, things like gravity, wind, rain, budget, and so on. Those really narrow your focus, your research, whereas an artist determines on their own the nature of that boundary, whether it's a rectangular canvas, a stage, or a hunk of clay or stone or something like that.
Yeah, right, Alan, I think... There's the means of realization also that in architecture certainly demands that a disciplinary conversation can be had about a project without it existing. You know, we can rely on drawings, we can rely on axonometrics, we can rely on models, whereas typically artists in some, maybe most cases, have the luxury of realizing the piece in order to critique it, right? And one could argue that architects are starting to have the luxury of visualizing the piece or the work to the extent that it can be critiqued as a realized object. I'm thinking of rendering techniques, visualization techniques that allow it to feel as though it's no longer a depiction of a piece, but it's the actual piece. At which point the critique becomes about it rather than some idea of it. So maybe that's merging, but...
That's my problem. Confusion as to whether the model was reality or not. Mm. And I always then said, I really like the model, and I love the renderings and the drawings more, and I had no interest in building. I really like...
That can happen in art, too, though. You create a model for something.
Right.
And then, or even you see a model of something, and you think that's going to be amazing, and then once you see it to scale... It doesn't fit. It does, you know, there are things about it that just aren't right.
I actually think this leads into my last question, which is actually about representation. And it's true that the sort of artwork often is a representation, whereas architecture has a very different relationship to representation, where one could argue that building didn't actually properly enter into an artistic discourse until it was paired with drawing and planning. That it developed sort of language and history of its own when drawing became the site of an architectural language, where one could possibly say that architecture's writing is the plan or the drawing, as opposed to the building, which in a kind of structuralist analysis could be architecture's speech. The drawing, and especially the plan, also become a site of possibly of architectural critique. But today, representation takes many forms outside of traditional drawing, though we do see that tradition referenced in the stairwell drawings in the show here, done in black electrical tape. But much of the other work here evidences these new representational techniques. We have work in video, we have work produced on the computer, and these all engage architectural representation in some way. And Molly Dilworth's large scale, her painting for Google Earth on the roof of this building, already anticipated future representation on the internet. But what are these issues surrounding representation today, and how are these concerns for both artists and architects? Personally, I would argue that many of the debates in architecture of the last decades, especially revolving around computer-generated form, for instance, have taken place primarily in representation and not through construction per se. So it's an important observation given the context of this show, which engages architecture explicitly, but often in a kind of fragmentary way, and it never deals with the discrete or whole building.
Just a very brief statement. That I think representation is sort of crucial. It's one of your tools for creating, and therefore that it's not just that you're trying to represent. It's actually that you're actually designing with that tool. And so it's become part of the piece completely. And it's not separate anymore. It's not, you know, that we're going to do a nice little drawing over here in order to represent this building, but rather that we're going to take that drawing and we're going to produce a piece that comes out of the way that we draw. And the computer has really changed the way that we draw completely. So, and we do something very different, but it becomes totally united to what we design, I think.
It's interesting. I try to tell my students that you're not designing anything, you're building. And it's just a continuum, and that you know, when you start to make a drawing, you're actually the beginning in the building process, and there is no separation between building and well, there's a very fine, there is no separation between construction and drawing. It's all on one kind of continuum. I'll pass it over to someone.
I always get really nervous when I'm asked to say something about representation because it's been talked about so much and there are very strong opinions. Impossible to make a definitive claim. But one thing is there are two different kinds of issues, I think, immediately, just in how the question was posed. One, regarding the forms of representation and possibly the biases that creep up on us, given if we design the work with charcoal versus on AutoCAD, right? And that somehow the work tends to be different, right? And or somehow the human touch is left, or, you know. So there are those kinds of questions about forms of representation, but I find more interesting just a more general question regarding representation, regarding meaning, and our strategies for addressing producing meaningful work. And I think there's a tendency to see architectural projects that have strong affiliations with strategies of representation as being somehow retro, because, and I also think that, because there's a tendency in those projects to project a single meaning, a single appropriate interpretation given by the designer. And that, I think, and I think we have the art world to thank for that, that's pretty much trashed, I think, as a general strategy. More interesting, I think, is addressing multiple or diverse ranges of meaning or meaning structures within the work, leaving it open-ended. I find that almost an inevitable thing. You can't really get past it, I think, given our current politics, to approach works of art or architecture in this kind of way. And it can get become a very technical, historical discussion, I think, within the art world or within the architecture world. What gives me a little bit of hope is maybe simplifying the issue a little bit, thinking about the representational strategies of a mountain, a physical reality. It's there. It means something. It's meant things to many people over many, many years. Poems have been written. Music have been written about it. But it's there. It's a physical reality. And somehow it didn't preclude the possibility of meaning. It actually encouraged it. And it became a kind of vessel for having life becoming more meaningful. So how we actually approach, I think about that quite a bit as an architect. How do you approach intervening in the physical world, producing physical realities that are maybe as open-ended as, say, a mountain would be, is interesting to me.
Well, I actually think this, the way I'm thinking about everything, that we've kind of come full circle, because if you think about art and how, you know, it's process versus meaning, sort of, whereas we have photography, then, you know, you can go through the process of film and all of that and then go into digital imaging, or, you know, you can have a sculpture and take a digital image of it and that could be the piece that you show, or, you know, there's so many representations of art now, which I think is also, which has brought us to these relationships with architecture, with dance, with performance, with that kind of, you know, we're starting from a different level, so it's kind of encouraging us to combine and work together in a way that we didn't have to do before. So I think that's kind of like bringing us back to, you know, to this show, back to art and art and architecture combined.
Just one final thing on representation. I spent a lot of time on a book that's coming out in the fall, which is a landscape manifesto, on the issue of representation. And basically, just saying that because I couldn't find a good way of representing landscape, that I felt that I didn't have the tools with which to do it. I couldn't design. I felt I couldn't design the landscape because I couldn't find a way of representing it. So, you know, I spent an enormous amount of time just feeling totally blocked until I could get to the point of trying to find a way to represent it. So it's very critical to.
I'm sounding really old and old-fashioned, but I think the medium is the message. I recently did a project where I built a brick wall using, and I drew it by using a mouse that was embedded in an actual brick. So, and I moved brick by brick in the drawing so that the drawing took as much time as it would take to build the actual brick wall. And my hands blistered, I sweated, I was exhausted by the end of a hard day working at the computer at the same rate that a brick mason would exhaust himself. I think there needs to be those equivalencies. I think if you want to change your ideas, you change your tools. And when you get stuck, you know, and you're using a number 2 pencil, try a number 8H pencil or an 8B or something. It really changes the work.
I think we need to find the equivalent of that exercise for some of our students, because with the quick roll of the mouse, you can go from, you know, a scale of 4 miles to... Right, exactly. There's no struggle to understand the discrepancies or disparities between different scales. One more point about representation, and maybe this is something Anne has thought a lot about, is the way that increasingly we're interested in representing things that are invisible, processes. And it seems as though there people who are exploring it are relying on old tools, old techniques to try to understand and try to depict how things that are invisible, weather patterns, growth patterns, actually occur. I wonder if you, Diana, think that there are ways to depict those patterns effectively, or if they're really things that we ought not represent.
Trying for certain, yeah. There are certain things in patterns that have to do with geology that I've been trying to represent for a while. I haven't gotten there yet, but I think that they are, that they express something, but I still don't have it.
I think we want to leave a little time for questions from audience members. I don't know if we want to continue with, is there a new question up there? Yeah, I think we kind of addressed that. If there's anything anyone would want to add to that, but if there's, all right. The last question is: what is the definition of architecture? Can it be as simple as any plan for a space with structure? Therefore, are all artists who create in space also architects? Almost anything can be called art nowadays. Throw up a bare canvas. What are the boundaries of what can be called architecture?
I think it's absolutely fruitless to try and answer a question like that from a philosophical point of view, come up with a kind of pure definition. But more pragmatically, I find that it's undeniable that each discipline has its own history. And without awareness or being within the flow of that history of architecture, I honestly would have no idea what being an architect was all about or what a piece of architecture is. And I'm sure similarly for the artist, I'm not as comfortable with making claims for art because I really have a very superficial engagement with the history of art. Or I'm not talking a kind of academic history, but just the fact that you're in an art world and you know people in that world, you have your own history through which you've gotten there, and somehow in these histories, I think you basically know if you're an artist or an architect. I think it's kind of undeniable in some sense. If there's puzzlement about where you are, I think it may be more a sign that the history might be more complex, and you may not be able to precisely decipher those historical trajectories.
Something that Loisha said stuck to me, that she said, you know, well, you're all architects, you know, sort of separating us from art, you know. And I think that the point was a good one in the sense that architecture is an art, landscape architecture is an art, you know, and yet we all know that art with a capital A has dominated all the 20th century, you know, and that the other one were called sort of like useful arts, you know, sort of put a little bit to the side. And what's happening now in this sort of bigger range, and I think that the words matter, is that we are creating a whole set of funny terms in order to vary something, what the architecture is or what the art is. And so you say land art, for example, because suddenly this new category has emerged. Or you call architopography, you know, because architects are sort of trying to imitate topographics, the topography where they are, and so on. So that those are indicating a shift, you know, in both of the fields, and then you have to invent some words for it. And therefore, just the art and architecture doesn't work quite as well anymore.
It does seem like, just coming out of the discussion, that there's certain utility sometimes in saying something is art, something's architecture, or even something is in between, and that you know, there's sort of multiple definitions for how one could see that, so, and it often has to do with this particular context and the space in which work is being done. And so it's easy to say that whatever is happening in a gallery space, that by definition going to be a kind of artistic practice. And I think a show like this is trying to question that, that maybe there's a kind of an architectural bias that can be brought into a traditional art space, and then what sort of happens, and how does that already change that space and actually try to change the context. So I don't think there's really an easy answer to this question, but there does seem to be almost a kind of performative functional bias on the part of this this panel to say that we're going to take advantage of whatever sort of opportunities those questions set up.
I know that the reason that I I posited that first question, or the second question after the "I love you, Michael," it's interesting that, you know, in this discussion, and I think what's been avoided, and it's often avoided, is if there is a context, you know, like Lefebvre sets up, you know, in the production of space, he says, you know, the context is economic, and no one has spoken about that. And also in talking about, like, interdisciplinarity and the everyday and that sort of thing, what I've heard a lot of is, what is the difference? What is the difference? For example, someone said that the difference is that one is self-directed research and the other is externally directed research. But I think that's what's missed, and what I think the most maybe utopian, maybe most advanced kind of thinking on architecture or art has driven at is to erase those boundaries and to say, you know, what is the similarity is that they're both directed research. And, you know, so where does the self and the external division occur? Not so much where is the difference between art and architecture, but, you know, is there a difference between the self and the external, you know, and the environment? And I think that what someone like Rudovsky's Architecture Without Architects is driving at is this breakdown of borders. You know, in fact, there are more people living in homes that are not designed by architects than are. And so, you know, what does that say? You know, is it just an economic order that defines what is art and architecture more than a gallery space, or even a gallery space is an economic structure? You know, it's a sales room. And then, you know, it's sold for a certain kind of home that's probably an architecturally designed home more than a non-architecturally designed home. So I think that is sort of the question that I was wondering about, and how is it that this kind of discussion remains concerned with the difference, and what is there, you know, what is there to be gained out of that difference, and is there a way to attain a more like what Vanagam called the totality for kids? You know, where can we borrow and collaborate and give, you know, artist and architect and citizen to the built environment? I don't know if that's very clear or not, but.
I can take a stab at part of that. One of the most interesting things that I think that you said was the possibility that there could be a greater degree of overlap between the externally directed and the self-directed research. I mean, I think in my opinion, if you critique work of architects, I would say that the best work is work that has a single thesis that threads through all of the work. And it's identifiable, it's palpable, it's clear in all of its different manifestations depending on site and context. And so I would hope that would be actually a similarity between the best artists and the best architects, that there is a kind of unified theme within which they're experimenting, regardless of whether it's an imposed site condition or context, or whether that's self-imposed. As I think artists probably have the same issue to deal with, you know, a space in a gallery or the way that the public interacts with the space, etc. So the identification of what that central thesis is, I think, the way that you can, in some sense, critique an artist and an architect, and there's no need to distinguish necessarily.
Maybe just picking up on a few examples from some of the works I see in this room, it seems like there are maybe sort of two primary ways to think about how architecture and maybe art as well might align themselves with certain sort of models of, say, economic efficiency. Somehow, on the one hand, there's this video sort of imagining a kind of sort of sustainable future where suddenly every building will have a solar panel facade, and somehow that seemed aligned with a certain sort of kind of technological utopia of a kind of economic efficiency. Or there's sort of this kind of more mournful structure that's taking maybe a more critical view of kind of Buckminster Fuller's, again, kind of utopia of economy. But then I think there's something very different with the Interborough video, which is trying to think what might happen with a mall when it's sort of left to rot because it's no longer financially viable or something, or will is being held to be sold for when property values increase at a future date. That somehow there's a place to locate a kind of architectural or artistic imagination in kind of economic inefficiencies. So I feel like there's a sort of range of practices within those two models, but it seems like some of the work here is starting to explore those in between areas.
I mean, just one comment. I think the question is something I appreciate because there's, I think, clearly a difference, and economically, it's most clear. The world, at least the economic world, sees the two as being very different things. But I'm not going to really give you an answer, really, but more a couple of anecdotes. A colleague of mine in Holland had really difficult time building a bridge and getting it through, mostly through approval process. And when they came back again after it got canned a couple of times, they came back again presenting it as an artwork, as a large-scale artwork, and went through no problem. Yeah, and nobody had any problem with it at that point, whereas before everybody was up in arms. On the other hand, there was another colleague who is an artist that built a bridge, an artist who built a bridge in Austria, actually. He explained it as just by taking off his artist hat and putting on the architect's hat. He went through all the steps, opened up an office, hired architecture students as employees, et cetera, went through everything. And he explained the whole compulsion he had to just be in the world in a way he's never been able to be in the world as an artist. And for him, all of the restrictions and the pain of actually calling it a bridge that had to go through approval process, it was incredibly pleasurable for him, he said, yeah, as he claims. So I don't know. Maybe there are just opportunities to find just pushing on the boundaries of what the artist or the architect is capable of doing.
Are there, maybe have one or two more questions, if there are any? One on the board. What is the meaning and purpose of the idea of discipline in the context of 21st century art and architectural practice towards an undisciplinary practice, which maybe kind of goes back to some of the discussions around interdisciplinarity or transdisciplinarity we had earlier?
Well, I think one of the benefits of disciplinarity is that work that operates within a discipline is critiquable. There's a way of understanding how to talk about a work if it's within a specific discipline. As soon as it creeps outside of that discipline, the rule set by which we appraise a work is out the door. And it's really difficult to have a conversation among a group of people, between a group of people, where there's potential agreement. So I'm thinking of Peter Eisenman in particular, who I think for a long time advocated for a discipline specificity, one that allowed the teachability of architecture and one that allowed for a method of critiquing that was shared among several critics.
Yeah, I think that's right, that there's something potentially, and I say potentially because often it's not the case, but something potentially resistant in disciplinarity, and that it's a rule set that's outside of the rule place or the marketplace, say, and so and often those things coincide, but I think that there's an aspiration that in setting up those boundaries, there's a kind of internal dialogue that's useful and can take place outside of all of those sort of external conditions that actually might be a kind of hindrance to working.
In the 60s, they said painting is dead, and it's not.
Well, I come out of a school of thought in architecture where I've been bombarded with a kind of insistence about the interiority of art discipline, and that this is the only way that architecture will move forward. By sticking within our discipline. And examples are given often, like, for example, somebody once said to me, like, Lobachevsky's great breakthrough in geometry, non-Euclidean geometry, could not have happened if there wasn't almost 1,500 years of obsession with Euclid and attempts to resolve certain difficulties with it. That it has to remain an expert practice. It's a practice conducted by experts, critiqued by experts, and it's the only way a breakthrough is achieved, right? And I always had some anxiety about that. In some circles, I think that's taken almost as a truth, but I could never quite understand exactly where the novelty will be introduced when it's always within the interior of what's already been done. That how are you ever going to jump that fence and some new animal is born when the gene pool is static, so to speak. So I think it's something that... if we talk about it in less technical terms, it's a quite severe problem, you know, how new forms of expressions or social institutions will emerge, and can it only be done by experts, right? So.
I think there's two issues in that involved in that. One is that the critique within the discipline and the vocabulary that one has developed, which is incredibly precise, is absolutely necessary for one to be able to think in terms of the discipline. But at the same time, once you have moved out of your discipline, what happens is that all kinds of thing happens by having these conversations with another person in another different artistic field. And I've had the experience with sculptors, and I've had the experience with video artists. With a video artist, that we are using the terms in a very different way, but at the same time, it opens a door, and we can't go on just talking to each other, right, within the discipline by itself, because I think it's necessary, and we never should lose it. But at the same time, we need the other part. And what I think you can't lose, and that's what I think that when I work with a video artist or when I work with a sculptor, is that we each have a set of tools, and that we are very good at using those tools and not the other tools. And therefore, I don't mess with whatever the sculptor is doing or the video artist is doing, and they don't mess with, you know, whatever I'm doing. But the dialogue is incredibly important, and the development of a kind of language.
I really just need to question one very basic premise that's been prevalent amongst all of you from the start, which is that there's one art and one architecture. And these are plural practices, and I'm about to, like, my head's going to blow off about it. So I just need that to be on the table. I just need that to really to be voiced with some exasperation, that we live in a place where the monolith has been at least as destructive as productive. And I make fairly traditional work in a lot of ways, but I still have, you know, enormous excitement at the multiplicity of conversations that could come out of this. And if you say that you need to start with terms from a place of expertise, I disagree. I think you need to develop a common set of terms for the duration of a conversation, and that would be really productive.
Well, I completely agree with you. These are absolutely plural things within which we assign these words, art and architecture. But that's the danger of the transdisciplinary experiment. You got to call it something, right? And you have to establish something about it in order for there to be even a possibility for a crossbreed. And I think this is oftentimes the critique that's leveled against all transdisciplinary collaborations. I find in my experience that there is, like I said before, a perception that the what seems to be native about each area is being diluted or being understood to be more simple than it actually is. Its full range is becoming narrowed, etc. So I think it's really important to know why you're doing it. You know, what is the purpose? What's to be gained? And the gain might be quite substantial, and if so, might be willing to suffer some of the injustices of the narrowing of the definitions.
In all fairness, there needs to be a plurality on the end of critique also for this to be symmetrical, in all fairness, because I think that also is being held up quite monolithically as a space of expertise, and that's problematic.
Maybe say something about the issue of boundaries and disciplines. Without disciplines, it's very difficult to know where we are in relationship to the world. It gives us something to bounce off of, to hit up against, in fact, maybe to almost bulge or break. So I think if we have a kind of undisciplined or no discipline, then it becomes nebulous and amoeba-like, and it's very difficult to understand our relationship to a world. And I think there are lots of boundaries, you know, lots of areas of expertises and boundaries, and we choose to work within those areas. For some reason, we find ourselves in that area, in that swimming pool, and we know how many laps we've gone in a particular session.
Yeah, it seems like we have to get really good at acts of translation in order to hybridize. Because I think one of the concerns that you might have alluded to, David, was that in translating one vocabulary into another discipline, it becomes simplified to the extent that it's no longer fruitful as an investigation. Dilution occurs. And on the flip side, though, there is the possibility for a tertiary set of vocabulary that is invented specifically for that project. And I see sometimes metaphors being used very loosely in academia, you know, going between music and architecture, for example, where the ideas that were so robust in each of the disciplines now become something that are weak in the other discipline. So the question becomes, how do you make that act of translation highly productive rather than reductive, which is something that I think we probably all want to get very good at.
Yeah, I think basically we find ourselves in this plural condition, whether we like it or not,
And the challenge is to sort of either retrofit terms or create new terms that help sort of navigate that that condition, which is why I think having this sort of bracketed space of a show like this is important, to really think what does it mean to have particular intersections today and in different fields and in new emerging kinds of fields. I think with that, though, it's about time to wrap up the discussion, so we'll just continue this around the show.
And as a gallerist, I just wanted to thank everyone for coming out. Thank you to our panelists, and let's enjoy a cocktail. Thank you so much. Thank you.